Philadelphia's financially troubled newspapers, the jointly owned Inquirer and Daily News, may be sold for the fourth time in 6 years. Readers may not know all the angles behind this story. As NPR's David Folkenflik found, the publisher has killed stories about the sale, while the leading bid appears to come from a group of powerful figures who are frequent subjects of the paper's reporting.
The Philadelphia Inquirer, a storied paper with a rich legacy of investigative reporting, and the Philadelphia Daily News, its scrappy sister tabloid, are found in the landmark building they've inhabited for decades. The appearance of permanence can deceive. The building was sold last year. Inquirer reporter Craig McCoy sits on a mezzanine overlooking a cavernous newsroom below, and he shakes his head as he thinks about a new round of layoffs and buyouts.
We face the constant battle here of cutbacks and reductions in staff, even as our obligations have grown. With all that said, I mean, the paper remains a great newspaper, and it's full of hard-hitting stories and beautifully written pieces every day.
Now, the hedge funds that own the newspaper's bankrupt parent company, the Philadelphia Media Network, are putting it up for sale. Earlier this month, local developer Bart Blatstein put out a press release saying he wanted to bid for the papers. Daily News political reporter Dave Gambacorta wrote a brief blog item and describes what happened next.
The blog post was pulled down. We reposted it. It was pulled down a second time and later replaced with a statement from Philadelphia Media Network, which indicated that they were not currently negotiating with Mr. Blatstein.
This made no sense at all, as Gambacorta points out.
By that point, the blog post had made the rounds on the Internet. A number of journalism websites had looked at it. A number of local readers had seen it. So when they were trying to click some links that I had put on Twitter and other places, they were finding a dead end.
A spokesman for the company took responsibility and later apologized. But journalists at the papers with direct knowledge of what occurred say it was publisher and CEO Greg Osberg who had killed a similar Inquirer story the day before. Osberg then appears to have lied to the New York Times about having an argument with editors over the incidents. Dave Gambacorta.
It's our job to ask tough questions, to shine a light on things that need to be examined. So to think that we were now actually going to be stopping ourselves from doing basic reporting on something as simple as the sale of our company, it raised a lot of troubling questions.
Hundreds of staffers signed a petition demanding a guarantee of editorial integrity, and executives promised no more interference. But Osberg's acts take on even greater weight because of who might own the papers next. A group seeking to buy them includes two of the region's most connected Democrats, former mayor and governor Ed Rendell and New Jersey political boss George Norcross III. Both men and their associates have been subjects of intense reporting. Former Inquirer columnist Buzz Bissinger asked Rendell about those ties on local radio station WPHT earlier this week.
You're the man in turn. You know more people in the state than anyone else. All these people are newsmakers.
And you're acting as if that this would be the first time that a group of people similarly situated own a newspaper. I mean, Walter Annenberg owned the Inquirer and Daily News, and he certainly was a power player that had tremendous business interests and tremendous ideas of what he wanted to do, what he didn't want to do.
It's worth noting that the late Walter Annenberg was considered one of the nation's most morally corrupt newspaper publishers of his era, pushing those interests and reviling his enemies in his news pages, not just in the editorials. Rendell promised a firewall separating his ownership group from the newsroom's reporting. But Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Wendy Ruderman of the Daily News points out that just such a tradition of newsroom independence has been breached.
There's a whole trust issue now. We're terrified, just terrified, that we're going to step on more landmines and not be able to do our jobs. And then we're not journalists anymore. We're not.
After the sale of the building, Ruderman says the newspaper's only remaining asset, the only thing they can offer their readers, is credibility.
If you're addicted to journalism like I am, if you love it, if you don't know what else you would want to do, then what's happening right now is kind of heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. And I think there's been so much stress here. Those places like imploding with stress.
It's not yet clear who will ultimately own the papers. If the hedge funds can't get a desired price, they may keep them and start cutting the newsroom in earnest. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
President Obama has apologized for the burning of copies of the Quran. The books were burned at a military base in Afghanistan. His apology follows days of demonstrations that have left a number of Afghans and two American soldiers dead. The thing is we're going to hear that in the Islamic faith, it is actually permitted to burn the Quran. It's all in how and why you do it. Turns out that in many religions, not just Islam, there are customs for disposing of sacred texts when they become old or damaged. NPR's Allison Keyes reports.
The Quran is considered to be the speech of God to humankind, word for word, explains Imam Jahari Abdul Malik.
The traditional way of disposing of used or damaged copies of the text of the Quran is by burning it.
But the director of outreach for the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, says that doesn't include burning it with the trash. That's what U.S. officials say mistakenly happened with the Qurans in Afghanistan. The imam, who spent time there in November of 2010, says the troops should have asked for guidance.
If one said, well, we're burning some Qurans today, that wouldn't incite riot in Afghanistan. The problem is when one puts the malicious intent as a part of the burning.
Imam Malik says the assumption there is that Americans disrespect Muslims, and that's why there would be such a visceral response to burning the Quran, even though a layperson could do so under Muslim law, as long as the intent was respectful. The Quran may also be buried. It should be wrapped in something pure and buried in a place where people do not walk. Many of the religious leaders we spoke to agreed that burial was the most respectful way to dispose of their sacred texts. In the Greek Orthodox Church, Bishop Adania says either a layperson or a clergyman could put the Holy Scripture to rest.
The appropriate way, if it was necessary to dispose of that item, it become torn or worn or aged, would either be to bury it or to burn it.
The bishop, who was chancellor of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, says no specific ceremony is involved.
In the case of most lay people, they would bring it to their church and let the parish priest dispose of it.
The Torah is handled with an enormous amount of respect.
Rabbi Menachem Ganach of the Orthodox Union explains.
Generally what's done is sacred texts are buried.
Ganach is the rabbinic administrator and CEO of the OU Kosher. He explains that Shemus, documents containing the name of God in Hebrew, are treated in a similar manner.
You can't just burn them or throw them in the garbage. So what is normally done is either they're buried, as a Torah would be, or they're put away.
The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America doesn't have an official policy for the disposal of Bibles, but Reverend Donald McCoy says,
for some, it would be burying, which would be a sacred thing to do, just as you would bury a loved one.
It should never be not seen to be revered or valued and treasured.
Monsignor Kevin Irwin is talking about the Bible. The Catholic University professor says he also prefers disposal by burial.
Because it is so sacred, and you don't want it to be perceived to be disgraced by even by burning.
The sense of the sacred is also paramount at the Baha'i National Center in Evanston, Illinois.
We feel that Baha'u'llah was a divine figure.
Thomas Murphy explains that the Baha'i faith is centered around a figure equal in stature to Jesus or Muhammad or Krishna, and his words are to be treated with respect.
There are no ceremonies attached to the treatment of books containing the sacred word.
Murphy says the disposal of books containing their sacred text must be done with a sense of dignity and reverence. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Block. If you're planning to take a long space voyage, say 9 months or so, to Mars, here's some advice. Bring Tabasco, or the hot sauce of your choice. That's because there's evidence that astronauts like to spice things up in space. And since NASA likes to keep its astronauts happy, the space agency is asking food scientists to help them craft a better menu for future missions. NPR's Joe Palca tells us what might be on it.
After a while in space, astronauts start craving foods they might never have liked on Earth.
They crave peppers. They crave sour and sweet things.
Jean Hunter is a food engineer at Cornell University. She's one of the scientists who will be helping NASA design the menu for future space voyagers. Besides a taste for hot peppers, Hunter says there are other kinds of changes.
Foods that rely on odor are less preferred.
That's because most of our sense of taste is based on smell. So a food that is only pleasurable for its smell isn't as yummy in space. For example, Hunter says the pleasure of coffee comes largely from its aroma.
If you hold your nose and you sip your coffee, you're getting just a bitter liquid.
So why do you lose your sense of smell in space? No one is sure. But there are some plausible ideas. Michelle Perchonik leads NASA's food science program. She says gravity, or more properly its absence, may be part of the problem. Hot air doesn't rise in a weightless environment.
And so the aromas aren't necessarily going to your nose. They may be going to your elbow.
Another possibility is what happens to the fluids in your body. On Earth, gravity tends to drag those fluids downward toward your feet. In space, they go everywhere, including to your head. So you look a bit like a cartoon character.
We call it the Charlie Brown face because their faces have gotten more round.
Round because they are retaining fluid in their heads.
And as they retain fluid, they also feel like they have a cold or they're congested, and again, they're not smelling as much.
Perchonik has asked Hunter and her crew at Cornell to test the stuffy nose theory. To do that on Earth, volunteers will spend several weeks in a bed where their heads are lower than their feet to try to recreate that Charlie Brown effect. Kim Binstead at the University of Hawaii at Manoa says there's actually an upside to losing your sense of smell in a small, enclosed environment like a spaceship or a tiny Mars outpost. She spent 4 months with six decidedly non-claustrophobic colleagues in a tiny sealed cabin in the Arctic, a Mars habitat simulation. No fresh air, no fresh food, limited water, so showers were once a week. She says it was cramped, but no one complained of the smell.
We felt it was pretty normal until we went outside at the end of our 4 months. And, you know, we spent a little time in the fresh air and then went back into the habitat. And, oh, Lordy, it was rank, absolutely rank.
So what do you put on the menu for people who are losing their sense of smell and can't get fresh supplies for months on end? To answer that question, Binstead is now planning to run another of these Mars habitat simulations to help NASA come up with some ideas. She says because you can store it for a long time, a staple on these menus is typically textured vegetable protein.
It's okay. I mean, it looks like dog food. It tastes a little bit like dog food, but it can be, with a bit of creativity, it can be made into quite good food.
And that's the direction Binstead is heading. She wants the people who will take part in her simulations to be creative with their cooking so they can please their changing palates. She plans to give them a wide variety of spices and herbs and as many different non-perishable ingredients as she can think of.
And this is great because they then take advantage of combinatorial explosion. So from a limited set of ingredients, you can get thousands and thousands of dishes.
Even without fresh fruits and vegetables, Binstead says it's possible to make some, shall we say, interesting culinary creations.
With powdered milk alone, you can make a pretty poor mozzarella, but it's a mozzarella anyway. And after you've not had fresh cheese for several months, even a little bit of not very good mozzarella is a wonderful, wonderful thing. You can melt it on some toast. You can make a basic pizza. It becomes a real treat.
And besides, figuring out new food combinations can help take your mind off the stress of being locked up in a tiny space with a half a dozen others. If the idea of pretending you're on Mars for 4 months is appealing to you, Binstead is still taking applications from people who want to join her simulation. There's a link on our website, npr.org. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the Academy Awards are this weekend, and if your ticket, like mine, somehow got lost in the mail, we'll ask about who else may be feeling left out of the Oscar party. Film director Reginald Hudlin tells us more about how the makeup of Academy members and their lack of diversity affects which movies and stars are recognized. That's in a few minutes. But first, it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. This week, the magazine turned its focus, as it does periodically, to an issue that touches all of our lives and that we care a lot about. It's education. The magazine took a look at graduate school. It is expensive. It's time-consuming. But a graduate degree can mean a big boost in salary. And that may be one reason why enrollment in graduate school is the highest it's been in decades, jumping 25% from the year 2000 to the year 2009, which is the latest number available from the federal government. But some people are now questioning whether a graduate degree is actually worth the cost. To help us answer that question, we called upon Anthony Carnevale. He is the director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University, and he was one of the people interviewed for the Washington Post piece, and he's with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for asking me.
So give us an idea, if you could, of who these graduate students are. Is there some trend? Are they people in their 20s, 30s? Do they tend to be men, women, professional schools?
They tend to be people who come from the more affluent families in America. They are the people who 40 years ago would have been the people who got the bachelor's degrees, and now they've moved on to graduate degree as the ante for good jobs continues to go up.
And when you say that the ante for good jobs continues to go up, are you suggesting that these degrees aren't really required for these positions? There isn't specific training that a graduate degree confers? I mean, I think most people would agree that an MD, which is a graduate degree, is pretty much a requirement. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want Joe says he's a doctor operating on me, but apart from that.
In general, what's happened in the labor market is that occupational skills are more and more important and more lucrative. And graduate degrees, almost universally, that is probably 80% of graduate degrees, prepare you for a specific occupational role. And as the requirements in occupations go up, employers prefer people with graduate degrees.
I did want to ask, though, how much of the increased enrollment in grad school is related to the economic downturn, that people are going to grad school because they can't get a job and they think it's a way to, in essence, ride out the recession. It's kind of an expensive way to ride out the recession, but do you think that that's part of it?
Whenever we have downturns, enrollment in college and in graduate school does tend to go up. The issue gets to be, when we come out the other side of the recession, how many people will actually finish. But in general, it is worth it. On average, a graduate degree in America is worth about $400,000 over a 40-year career.
Well, that sounds like it is worth it. But there is, I want to go back to something you said at the beginning of our conversation, which is that the people who go to grad school tend already to be affluent. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
The American education system, especially after high school, has become more and more stratified. That is, it is more and more the case that whiter and more affluent students complete more and more years of schooling, and non-white and lower-income students tend to complete fewer. So part of the sorting process in the United States is the post-secondary education system. It is disturbing to the extent that post-secondary education or education after high school, how much you get and what you get it in, pretty much determines what your career prospects are.
You know, we talk about gaps early in the education process. We tend to talk about achievement gaps in, say, elementary school and in secondary school. And what I'm interested in is whether what you've called credential creep or this growing preference for graduate degrees, does that reinforce a gap that already exists? Or does it help women and minorities and people who've been left out before, does it help them compensate for existing gaps, or does it just reinforce it?
The increasing demand for education, college and graduate, is a dilemma. Education in America is a way towards opportunity. It promotes opportunity, but it has become increasingly a barrier to opportunity because it holds people out of particular occupations in the labor market, and the increase in the demand for graduate school has made that stratification worse.
One of the other things I was interested in is that you've talked about the fact that people with a graduate degree tend to be able to earn more over time. Does it almost always work that way? Because I'm thinking about people in fields like social work and elementary and secondary teaching, which are not known to be highly compensated. Does it work that way as well, that a master's degree or a graduate degree improves your earnings over time?
Rule number one in choosing colleges and programs, graduate or undergraduate, is that what you take will determine what you make. So there is wide variation. So, for instance, among master's degrees, you'll only earn a few thousand dollars more if you get a master's degree in the arts. If you get a master's degree in chemistry after getting a BA in chemistry, you'll earn $30,000 to $40,000 more. So it's all in the subject matter and the way it connects to the labor market.
We're talking about why so many more Americans are studying for graduate degrees and whether that work and the cost pays off in the end. My guest is Anthony Carnevale of Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He was quoted in this week's Washington Post magazine, which focused on education. This was one of the issues that the magazine focused on. Is there any way in which the preference for graduate education, is there any part of that that is a reflection of a lack of quality education prior to the graduate level? And in the same way that we see a number of colleges and universities increasingly offering courses in remedial writing or writing and what some would argue are basic skills that should have been mastered before that, is there any way in which educational deficits are just being pushed along?
There's a temptation to think of graduate school and even the bachelor's degree as compensation for poor education. That is, we're getting more and more graduate degrees because the people who get bachelor's degrees are less and less skilled, and that's not true. People who get bachelor's degrees are, in fact, more and more skilled. What has changed is that the economy is demanding significantly more skill in a whole series of occupations that now require graduate education that did not before.
Is this a subject that's being discussed in the academy? Is this something that educators are concerned about? Is this good for the country, I guess, is the question.
It is good for the country, and it is good for the people who have access to graduate programs. But it raises the basic American question, or at least one of the basic American questions, and that is that we've built a new part of the life cycle which requires that people get more and more college education and graduate education to get good jobs, and that is what's sorting us out.
Hmm. And is that a conversation that is being had among the institutions that are in a position to offer this opportunity, or?
This is not something that's widely discussed. Most of the conversation about higher education has to do with who goes to Harvard and who goes to the state university or the community college. We all tend to think in the United States of college as an equalizing force, but it's become a force that creates more inequality among us. It's both an opportunity and a barrier to opportunity.
What kinds of conversations would you like us to be having about this?
I think in the 1970s, we were concerned that we were rooting people through high school, some to college and some not, and we decided to change that in 1983 with the Nation at Risk report that said that we've got to get more kids able to go to college. I think we're reproducing the tracking that we produced in the 70s in our college education institutions now. That is, the inequality shows up in college. The great sorting of Americans is now occurring in college and graduate school.
Is this the kind of thing that people should be yelling about, or is this just the way it is and people need to get wise to it? Because one would think that our core sense of self as Americans is that we offer opportunity to those who are willing to work for it. And it should not be about who your father was or who your mother was or essentially picking the right parents. But what I'm hearing you say, it increasingly is.
In the American mind, the issue of the moment is how we get enough money to pay for access to college. It has been much less concerned about the stratification in the college system itself and in the difference between people who get two-year degrees, BAs, and graduate degrees. So the equity question really hasn't come up. Most of the concern is about access, about giving people access to post-secondary. We pay much less attention to the outcomes and their meaning for upward mobility in America, but to some extent, post-secondary education has become a part of the machinery that pretty much guarantees the intergenerational reproduction of privilege.
Anthony Carnevale is the director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University, and he was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. He was quoted in this week's Washington Post magazine piece titled Graduate Degrees, Are They Worth It? That piece was by Cecilia Capuzzi-Simon. Mr. Carnevale, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for asking me.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. There is a civil war going on in California. It's the South versus the North, Hollywood versus Silicon Valley. The cause? Intellectual property rights. One of the highest profile battles was fought last month when large internet sites such as Wikipedia staged an online blackout. They were protesting anti-piracy bills in Congress. Silicon Valley won that battle. For now, the legislation is on hold. But as NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the conflict is far from over.
In the South, Hollywood, there are the people making their livings off of music, movies, and TV. Southerner Gavin Pallone is an executive producer on such shows as The Gilmore Girls and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
What is the key element? Is that a movie or a television show or a song or a book is actually someone's property?
and to Pallone and other Southerners, taking that property without permission is a criminal act. That's why Hollywood has used the law to try and shut down the revolving door of sites that traffic in music, movies, television, and film, from Napster to Mega Upload. But up north in Silicon Valley, in the hub of technological innovation and newly minted millionaires and billionaires, techies like Tim O'Reilly have a different view.
I'm a creature of a technology world where you accept a high level of competition and you don't have a lot of respect for businesses protecting their turf except by innovating.
O'Reilly is founder of a publishing company that's part of O'Reilly Media. It publishes technology-oriented ebooks on topics like how to get the most out of your iPad 2 or how to program iOS 5.
If things are being pirated, people want them. And I would far rather have one of my products discover that it's highly pirated than that it isn't, because what that tells me is a lot of people want it.
In fact, O'Reilly says a study of his customers proved that many paid later for what they at first took.
We found that the people who pirated were actually also the people who paid us more. They had a budget.
But ebooks are also advertisements for O'Reilly's other products, tech classes, and business conferences. Less than 50% of his company's income comes from ebooks. Making a movie is another kind of project altogether. Take an independent film like Suing the Devil, starring Malcolm McDowell as the devil himself.
How many people are going to sue me and blame me because they can't get their act together, huh?
Tim Che directed the film, and he knows exactly what it cost to make.
Each camera costs $150,000 with all the setups and everything. So we're talking $300,000 just on the camera. Then we have sound, we have special effects.
And the list goes on. Che has a law degree from Harvard, but he's not rich, and he doesn't spend his time thinking about business models. He and his colleagues put their innovations into their films.
We do it for the art. We do it because we want to tell our stories, express our stories. I, as a filmmaker, am not in it for the money.
But he's got to pay his bills. So when he saw his film up on the internet for free before it was even released...
It can make you cry as a filmmaker. It can make you cry. I mean, all of that work.
But what made him want to take legal action was when he asked the website Pirate Bay to take down his film.
The guy wrote back and said this: "We've never taken any of our movies off of our site. Why would we take yours off?"
Appropriation of intellectual property has always existed. The internet just makes it easier, says Ben Hunt, the CEO of Cheeseburger Network, a company that runs a group of popular sites featuring amateur humor like lolcats, funny captions over pictures of cats. Hunt says content creators and the government need to start thinking differently.
It's almost like we're entering prohibition again, where the public perception towards copyright no longer matches the legal perception of copyright.
Like most techies, he starts talking about business models and giving customers what they want to minimize the number of people who steal. If people don't want to go to the movie theater to see the latest film, Ha says they should be able to see it at home legally.
And I'll pay you extra so I don't have to schlep my butt out in the snow, sit with a bunch of teenagers who talk behind me and use their cell phone. Why does that not exist?
In the end, these two industries may need each other more than they currently realize. This year, Google's YouTube commissioned professionals in Hollywood and New York to create channels on the site because the folks at Google didn't have the talent or expertise. Southerner Gavin Pallone thinks eventually the Northerners will start to see the situation differently as they see how much it costs to make high-quality content.
They'll be the same as these media companies that they're rallying against right now. And they will also start to look at this very expensive property as property, and they're not going to want to have it stolen from them.
But both sides continue to wage war using the weapons they know best, whether it's the courts or the internet. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.